funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the relationship between American cars and American culture? For better or for worse, we would not be the country we are today without our famous attachment to our automobiles. So what does a carbon-limited future portend for life in the United States? The latest book of essays by writer P.J. O'Rourke explores these questions with characteristic wit and self-deprecation. It's called Driving Like Crazy, 30 Years of Vehicular Hellbending. He's in town to address the Dallas Committee on Foreign Relations. We're delighted that he could make time to be here in our studios. P.J., welcome to Think.
Hey, thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
You say that it's time to say sayonara to the American car. Why is the future so bleak?
Well, I think it's bleak only in a psychological sense. I think as industries, automobiles will continue to exist. And, of course, as something that we all have to have, whether we want or not, almost all of us, they certainly will consider. But, you know, what has happened is that the automobile has ceased to be an instrument of mobility and fun and begun to be an appliance. And kind of like our cell phones and our laptops, kind of an annoying, nagging appliance. There's all this stuff that we have to do. The car is sitting there in the driveway saying to us, you know, you have to have the kids to school 10 miles in one direction, and you have to get to work 10 miles in the other direction, and then you've got to go shopping 10 miles in the direction of neither the school nor the office, and so on and so forth. And we spend all our time in a friend of mine from here in Fort Worth, Lee Bass, calls the modern car a motorized cup holder. You know, and it kind of doesn't matter anymore whether it's a $500,000 motorized Ferrari cup holder or whether it's a cash for clunkers $500 motorized cup holder. You're stuck in there. Here you are in the richest country in the world, occupying for most of your day less space than the guys on in a cubicle farm, a tech support place in Mumbai. You know, it's, and so a love affair. The car isn't gone, but our love affair, the thrill is gone.
Why do you imagine we're not fighting back to keep that lover?
Well, because we can't. Social circumstances are what have changed the role of the car. It isn't anything we can do about the car itself. The fact that we're all living out in trout antler acres, you know, and
8,000 square feet, though.
Yeah, it's got 8,000 square feet. The 8,000 square feet and a mortgage that's deep underwater. I feel your pain. I'm there myself. I live in the middle of nowhere. There's a whole range of sociological and indeed political things that have caused so many Americans to be so far away from everything else they do. I mean, one of the things, of course, has been the decentralization of our economy. Our economy has moved out and away from center cities. But there's also the disaster that many center cities provided, the high crimes, the bad high crime rates, the bad educational system, the crowded living circumstances, the corruption, the high taxes. There's a reason we moved to the burbs. And then there's as the suburbs got older, there was a reason we moved to the exurbs. As suburbs began to show some of the same problems that inner cities had. And these are problems that have nothing to do with the car. And then while we were in the midst of clearing out of the cities for various political and sociological reasons, we were also in the midst of building a heck of an expressway system in this country that allowed us to move out of the cities. The original intent of the Eisenhower interstate system was to be able to go between cities. But its effect, actually, was to destroy cities and to allow us to live outside cities. I come from Toledo, Ohio, a city that basically no longer exists. I mean, it's just kind of it's a donut city. There's suburbs all around it, and there's a hole in the middle. Yeah. And I always think of it as a 20-minute city. There's no place in the Toledo metropolitan area that is more than 20 minutes from any other place because it's all full of empty expressways built to serve a city that no longer exists.
So cars did it to us and for us at the same time.
I would say more for us than to us. There's a tendency in some urban planner and sort of kind of well-meaning busybodies who always want to change our lives for us. There's a tendency to blame the car. I think that it would be more accurate probably to blame just crime and school systems would be two huge things. Desire for a bigger house and a bigger yard, too. There's certainly that. But if you were looking for something that got people outside the city limits, the rise of crime and the decline of city school systems would probably be the two biggest things that would make people, married people with kids at any rate, make them move.
So do you think the promise of that easy, quick, relatively affordable transportation was not exactly what it was supposed to be?
Well, I don't think there's anything supposed to be about it. It was just there. Mass production made the automobile relatively inexpensive. Low energy costs made the automobile relatively inexpensive to use. And so that was just that. There was no intention here. It was just a fact of the matter. Are energy costs going to rise to a point where we have to rethink this whole? The answer to that is probably no. The answer to that is probably no. It's a little hard to say, but despite all the sort of panic about use of running out of oil and then the sort of extra layer of frosting of panic about destroying the climate, carbon-based fuels remain plentiful and fundamentally pretty cheap. I mean, exogenous forces, wars, and indeed growth in places like China and India may drive them up a little bit, but there's still a mess of coal. And we just saw a huge oil field discovered yesterday, announced by BP.
Out in the Gulf.
Right? Very deep out in the Gulf. Now, will our worries about the climate and our concerns about ecology be enough to stop the extraction and processing of these carbon fuels that everybody needs every day? No. No. They may drive up the price a little bit. They may drive up the price of our vehicles the way catalytic converters did. They may drive up the price of gasoline a little bit. They may drive up the price of corn, for that matter, the way ethanol has. But they aren't going to fundamentally alter the equation. There are too many. There's a kind of pocketbook democracy involved here that no matter how much certain elites might want energy to be extremely expensive and might want energy to be very sparingly used, there are billions of people on this earth, and they vote with their wallets, and that's a force that elites really can't stand in the way of, or they will cease to be elite.
You grew up the son of a guy who sold Buicks for a living.
Absolutely.
Your first job was washing cars.
Yeah, I was out on the family Buick deal. Not only did I grow up as a son of a car salesman, my family family exists because of the automobile. My grandfather was born in 1888, and he was born in a little place called Lime City, Ohio. Not a city. No limes. He was born on a little like a bedspread patch of dirt farm. His father, who was a bad alcoholic, my great-grandfather Barney, was a woodcutter, a lumberjack by trade. Now, this is the Midwest. No trees. Barney was out of work a lot. Grandpa was one of 10 kids. He had about a fifth grade education. And as soon as he could, and he was probably about 11 or 12, he lit out for the big city bright lights, which was Toledo, where he became a wagon mechanic. He worked on wagons and carriages. We think of wagons and carriages as being painfully simple sort of radio flyer vehicles, but they actually had a fairly sophisticated – some of them had fairly sophisticated suspension systems and steering mechanisms and axles and wheels and so on, which there were such a thing as wagon mechanics.
So you'd have to bring your wagon into
the shop. Yeah, you have to bring your wagon into the shop when it quit working right, just like the car. And one day, at the buggy repair shop, up pulled a horseless buggy. And Grandpa, who always called cars, to the end of his days, called cars buggies, he got the idea immediately. And he became a car mechanic. And it wasn't long before he figured out that there was more money to be made and cleaner hands to be had selling the things rather than fixing them. And so he became a salesman for the Willys Company, which would later go on to produce Jeeps, which is based in Toledo, and for many years, and then started out on his own with various car dealerships. And it was a Buick dealership when I was a kid. And Grandpa, my father's oldest brother, owned the place, and Dad was the sales manager, and the baby brother. Jack was a salesman. Uncle Joe ran the car lot, and the whole family worked there. And so we just wouldn't exist. We'd have been out there in Lime City dead of Lyme disease if it hadn't been for the car. We wouldn't be reading or writing or anything. You know?
And even aside from the fact that you guys sold Buicks, this was an era when everybody was very loyal. They liked Fords or they liked GM cars, or you didn't sort of cross brands.
Not often, no. Although you might stay within, you might move up. General Motors had it sort of set up, so there was a whole life progress there. You started out with a Chevrolet when you were had your first job, and then you'd move up to a sporty Pontiac, and then when the kids came along, you know, and you were doing better, you could get an Oldsmobile, and then as you moved up the corporate ladder, a Buick, and finally when success and retirement came along, a Cadillac. You know, it was a whole little ladder of progression. But generally, there were GM people, there were Ford people, and there were Chrysler people, and kids would argue. Kids would get in fights about this stuff. There were Pontiac families, and there were Dodge families, and there were Ford Mercury families, and kids, you know, little 10-year-old boys that actually hit each other about this stuff. It's very hard to imagine, you know. I don't think I'll ever be able to explain this to my own kids, you know, who regard a car as a motorized cup holder.
Yeah, it's amazing shopping for cars, particularly family cars. One of the big things that they tout now is all the storage that a car has in it, which seems a funny thing that you're going from point A to point B, but people sort of keep a lot of their possessions in their cars.
The small-scale storage. They're not talking about the big luggage storage. They're talking about all the little nooks and crannies that are around you, so you can have your cell phone and your iPod and your wallet and purse and all the rest of the stuff. Really indicates how much time you spend in the car. And one of the things, one of the criticisms car salespeople, car marketing people will give you about European cars, and one of the reasons that say that Volkswagen and some of the other European cars may not have sold as well as the Japanese cars was interior ergonomics. Or not just ergonomics, but interior convenience. No cup holders. For years, you couldn't convince the Europeans, because why? Europeans stop and have a cup of coffee. Why would you pick up the restaurant's cup and take it out to your car? You know, Europeans just had no sense, and still don't, I think, in many ways, of the amount of time Americans spend in their cars. Just as they really have no sense of the scale of America. I remember years ago, some European friends of mine came over to visit a friend of theirs and mine, and they sat down with a map of America, and they said, well, this is in New York. And they said, well, we're going to go out to Chicago tomorrow and then Los Angeles the next day. No, you're not.
Very different trip came about, I'm sure. P.J. O'Rourke is with us. His newest book is called Driving Like Crazy, 30 Years of Vehicular Hellbending. Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer P.J. O'Rourke. His newest book is called Driving Like Crazy, 30 Years of Vehicular Hellbending. P.J., what goes into really good writing about cars and about driving?
Well, a very important question, because there's a whole school of buff book writing. This would include the car magazines, the sports magazines, Sports Illustrated, but also things like skiing, outdoors writing, writing about people's hobbies. And the bar tends to be low. I think one of the reasons that I gravitated towards writing about my hobby, my interest, was that it was easier to be a better writer. then, because a lot of the writing was just awful. And there was a guy, David Davis, who founded Car and Driver magazine, ran it, and then was an advertising executive for a while, was brought back to kind of get Car and Driver restarted in the 70s. That was when I got involved with Car and Driver. Went on to found Automobile magazine, is back at Car and Driver now. David was one of the people who demanded that just because we're writing about cars doesn't let you off the hook for being a decent writer.
You have to be a storyteller.
You have to be a storyteller. You have to keep the audience's attention, and the verb has to agree with the subject. And it's interesting, Sports Illustrated was also very demanding about its quality of writing. And Davis and his came along not long after Sports Illustrated. And so there has been a movement over the years to raise the level of writing about interests. This has all been completely undercut by the web. You can now go on the web and listen to people blog about anything they're interested in, listen to, read them. If you can call it reading. And so the standard of writing about enthusiasms has plummeted again to the near illiterate, to the semi-literate.
I guess you have to ask yourself if anybody is reading that substandard writing. You know, everybody can create a blog, but they don't necessarily have an audience.
Yes, there are more. It's sort of like modern poetry. There are more blogs written than read. There's no doubt about that. You know, in fact, reading some modern poets, I think they themselves may have written more poetry than they have read. They haven't even been reading their own poetry. So I really don't know whether – I assume that will straighten itself out, you know, that quality will again rise to the top, but perhaps not in my lifetime.
You included at the beginning of the book an essay that you wrote when you were 31?
Yes.
Yeah. Then you –
31 with a mental age of about 19.
Well, you go back later and sort of talk to your younger self. And one of the things that you wrote when you were 31 was that fun is whatever makes your mother cry. And now you say fun is what makes your wife go back to her mother. What's the difference between those two things? What's in the categories?
It's I think this is something that will always divide the sexes. That the male ideas of fun, always involve, as we may say, tears before bedtime, it's all fun and games till somebody gets their eyes poked out. It's just that men have somewhere, deep in their DNA, a desire to roll the lawn chair off the high diving, the high board at the public pool, or attach.
With baby brother on it, if
with baby brother on it, if possible. It's Jeff Foxworthy says it's the last word, redneck's last words. Or, hey, y'all, look at this. And certainly there is an element, especially when I was younger, to my car riding, to all of our car riding. I mean, one time back in the 80s, a whole bunch of us from Car and Driver, including grown-ups who should have known better, we decided to take, I think it was about six of that era's sport sedans, none of them being particularly memorable cars, except for the Audi, I think it was the Audi, what was it called in those days? Audi 1000 or 100 or something that got famous for going through the backs of people's garages when they didn't want it. Unintended acceleration. It was just because the brake and it was because people were wearing big fat shoes.
They were too close together,
right? The brake and the accelerator were a little closer together than they are in American cars. It really wasn't the Audi's fault. It was the Audi driver's
large
fault.
American feet.
It was large American feet was the fault. But never mind. Anyway, we decided to take these cars down to Baja. Now, this is before the Baja is the Cabo San Lucas, hurricane victim. I mean, hurricane could have gone through the Baja in those days and, nobody would have even known it. So only about 11 people living down there. And so we took these all the way down from Tijuana all the way to the tip of Cabo San Lucas, and we just destroyed these cars. We didn't mean to, But I mean, one of the tech director Don Sherman drove one into a flooded Vado and a Datsun, killed its computer. I remember we took the computer out of the car and we were trying to fix it by drying it off with hair dryers. We all had hair dryers, of course, because it was the 80s.
Even in the Baja, we were carrying our –
you think it's just women. It's not. We were carrying our hair dryers. I think I said in my story that we knew that we decided it was too dangerous to drive after dark in the Baja because of the wandering cattle. Cattle aren't fenced down there. So we decided it was too dangerous to drive after dark. Unfortunately, we decided this after dark. Whereupon, Chubba Chetta, who would go on to be editor of Car and Driver magazine, smacked into this cow. I mean, actually a steer, about 800 pounds of steer. Flipped it up into the air. The thing landed. Its horns landed, put two perfect little dents in the roof of this car before it flipped off to the side of the road and turned into hamburger. And we were arrested about four or five different times, not for drugs or drunkenness or anything, but for not reporting an accident with a cow, among other things.
And you learned the fine art of mordida.
Mordida, yes, yeah. We did indeed. Yeah, I remember one time we got arrested for, we were going like 100 miles an hour right through the middle of town, and we were traveling in an illegal convoy, according to Mexican police. And we had somebody with us who spoke Spanish, so we could actually hear, understand all the things that they were telling us that we'd done wrong, and not reporting an accident and killing a cow and who knows what else. And it was like, you know, life in prison sort of stuff. You know, we're talking felonies here. And when we got it all sorted out and got down to brass tacks about this, it cost us $15 in bribes to get out of all that. This is the old days before automatic weapons and drug cartels and
kind of a gentler place.
It was. It actually was. I mean, Mexico just couldn't have been more fun those days.
It strikes me that the most dangerous part of your journey, despite what you've just described, was the food.
That could happen.
You spent the whole trip with someone being
actually, a couple of different forays into Mexico. Yes, somebody would always forget and eat the salad. I was a foreign correspondent for 20 years besides being a car nut. And there's a lot of contraintuitive stuff about not getting sick. For instance, ceviche, you'd think that would send you directly to, you know, to medvac.
Because it's not cooked, it's just
not
cured
cooked.
In lime.
It's just, it's just, you know, it's raw fish soaked in lime, you know. And, but no, the lime is so acidic, it kills everything. You can eat ceviche right off the street. But the fanciest restaurant in Mexico City, you can't have the salad. But you don't know that when you're a kid. So.
We'll go to the phones now and speak with Bill in University Park. Hey, Bill.
Hi.
Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I have a couple friends and relatives who have worked in the car sales business lately, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but it's not very lucrative anymore, at least if you're anyone besides the owner of the dealership. My stepdaughter works at a Porsche dealership, and you could sell a $100,000 Porsche, and they basically give you like a couple hundred dollars now as a commission.
That's just horrible, you know. I mean,
isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm not even sure it's doing so well for the guys that own the dealerships. I think there was a time, you know, when they the little dealerships like we had went out. We sold our franchise back in the 70s when these big auto fair sort of places came in the suburbs, and you'd go out and there'd be nine dealerships, each on 15, 20 acres. And I think that's when being a car salesman ceased to be a very lucrative. But then being a car dealer ceased to be very lucrative either. Yeah, I know. I don't know. You know, it's beginning. The whole automobile industry is beginning to resemble what they used to say about the Irish on Manhattan's west side, was that they made a living by taking in each other's laundry. I don't know where it's going.
We have an email here from Cannon, who is listening to the show from his car, and writes, I grew up in an era when, as young boys, we did believe our family car, which was a Chrysler, was the finest. I haven't driven a U.S.-made car in 15 years. Looking forward 15 years, what do you see the car market to look like, particularly in the U.S., and can U.S. car makers ever fully recover?
I don't think that the U.S. car makers really are going to recover enormously, at least with the low end of the buying spectrum, because first the Japanese, now the Koreans, soon the Chinese and the Indians build cheap cars cheaply and well. Well, that was the, you know, people have long forgotten that the initial Japanese foray into the American market, which was largely on the West Coast, was a disaster. The cars were horrible. They had hilarious names like the Itty Bitty Sunflower, you know, and there actually was a Datsun Fair Lady and a Datsun Ladybug. You know, nobody's driving a ladybug. You know, out of here. And they weren't cute cars either. They were just, they looked like they'd been designed in the dark. And the Japanese were chased away from our shores, much as they had been in World War II. They came back, however, and they learned their lesson.
With a vengeance.
With a vengeance. And they learned also from the failure of the various European brands, all the British cars that used to be around, and only Mercedes and Volkswagen had succeeded really in the import market in the United States. Fiat had been chased out of the United States. The British stuff all went away. French stuff, the Peugeots, never made much of an impact. And the secret was dealership network. And the Japanese built their dealership networks very carefully. And they also built reliable cars. It took them a long time before they got their styling straight. And they still don't always do such a great job. But they got their – when they came back with things like the Datsun 510, they came back with an inexpensive product that was solidly built and had a good dealership network behind it. And they moved across the country gradually. They started out in California. Koreans did the same thing. Hyundai followed the same. Kia followed the same path. And I have a feeling that Chery from China and whoever comes – Tata is from India – on the other hand, when you get up to bigger vehicles, trucks and minivans, big SUVs, you are talking about a lot of money to transport these. Even if you have some place cheap to build them well, you are talking about the transport costs for something like this, just in terms of weight, are pretty considerable. And also, these are vehicles that really only exist for the American market. There may be a few other places like South Africa and Australia where these vehicles are useful, but fundamentally they're American market vehicles. They're big vehicles for big people, big families, big distances to cover, and a bunch of junk to carry around. And I think we're probably going to remain tops in building those. But we won't see the American, you know, just flat-out domination of the world auto industry ever again.
You got two Suburbans in your garage?
We have two Suburbans.
And three kids and two Suburbans.
Three kids, three dogs, and two Suburbans. Well, one is my old hunting car, which is basically just, you know, kind of a giant dog bed. It doesn't it gets about 3,000 miles, 4,000 miles a year on it. But the other one is our workhorse. We live in rural New Hampshire. The weather is severe. It's hilly terrain. The roads are not great. And one thing my wife says, come the middle of winter, transporting three kids to school early in the morning, it's not light yet. She didn't feel safe in anything, you know, that weighs less than 5,000 pounds, you know. And they are great vehicles. There's absolutely no doubt about it. We can take all three of the kids and everything that we need to, with us for trip cross country. We take everything we own except the swing set. You know? We tried, a year and a half ago, we took a very nice trip from Los Angeles to Denver in a Ford Flex. In a new sort of mid-sized Ford. What's really a station wagon is what it is. Not quite enough room. You know, we were pretty much limited to the kind of restaurants that let you in without shirts or shoes. You know, there wasn't room for a necktie. When we got all the stuff packed together, it was a tight squeeze with all three kids. And Americans need that space.
Have your thoughts about the fun and the danger element of cars changed now that you can imagine a day when your kids get their learner's permits?
the danger thing, definitely. You know, I mean, I think that every parent owes it to every kid to sit them down when they get their license and say, if you get drunk, if you get stoned, if you get – you don't – there will not be a word of reprimand from – you just call. And I don't care if it's 4 in the morning. I don't care if it's 5 in the morning. If you feel you can't – you're not safe to drive. And start feeling not safe to drive real soon, like right after that first beer. Because, is you know, the problem is really a boys and bravery. You know, it's boys like to be brave. And, you know, I probably girls don't come right out and admit this the way they did in my day, but I think girls like boys to be brave too. And beer makes boys brave.
Brave and stupid.
Oh, they're already stupid. You can make them any stupider. You know? You take a 16-year-old boy, he's dumb, D-U-M, dumb. He doesn't know how much a whole mess of nines are, especially when there are girls around. But yeah, beer doesn't make them any brighter either. You know, but it makes them braver. You know, it's all, I almost, you know, I'd never say this to my kids, but I almost think, you know, that at least pot, like, makes them less brave. So let's keep that between ourselves.
They're not listening. They're in another market.
They're
right
in
now.
Another market. Yeah.
T.J. O'Rourke is with us. His new book is called Driving Like Crazy, 30 Years of Vehicular Hellbending.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
Chris Boyd, you're listening to an archive edition of Think. P.J. O'Rourke came to town to address the Dallas Committee on Foreign Relations and has made some time to talk about his new book, Driving Like Crazy, 30 Years of Vehicular Hellbending. That's where we hook up with Ed from Dallas. Hi, Ed.
Hi. O'Rourke, how young were you when you got your driver's license?
Oh, 16 in one day or something like that. You know, I mean, I remember that I flunked my test. It was the day that President Kennedy was assassinated, 1963. I just turned 16, and I'd passed my written test. And Illinois used to have a pretty they had a little course laid out, like a little go-kart track, and with all sorts of hidden stop signs, and speed traps and so on, and I flunked my test, and I was pretty bummed out already, and then came back, and the president was shot. It was a bad day all around.
Now, did you conceal that fact from your friends that you had failed the first time?
Well, I think fortunately I was sort of overtaken by events. I probably would have let it go unmentioned, you know, but fortunately everybody was pretty exercised about the events of the day. But, yeah, I learned it. But I learned to drive. I mean, I don't even remember learning how to drive. I remember learning how to drive stick shift. But as far – I mean, my dad would sit me on his lap, this is before airbags or seatbelts or anything, and let me drive the car on the highway while he worked the pedals. You know? I mean, I was about 8. And so, I mean, my dad died when I was – just before I was 9, so I had to be less than 9 when he was doing this. And, yeah, you just kind of achieved driving by osmosis in my era.
Do you have a dream car now?
I actually love the automobile I've got. I've got my little precious baby is a 1990 Porsche 911, which is before Porsches were expensive. I actually bought mine from a dentist who scared himself. It had about 5,000 miles on it.
Risky.
Yeah, he was just frightened of it, and he sold it at a pretty good discount and bought a Lexus. And so I got the 911. It's very simple, just a Carrera 2, and it's just black, and the only option it's got on it is a sunroof. And I just love that car. It'll do 150 miles an hour. Not that there's any opportunity for me to do that in the part of New England where I live, but it's all the car I ever need. If I could have any car in the world, there are all sorts of old cars that I would love to have. I'd love to have an old Alfa and do some there's a wonderful world of kind of vintage rallying out there. And getting to be a vintage guy, I'll be 62 this year, so it suits my age. And unfortunately, the cars for it are expensive to buy and expensive to maintain. So I suppose my dream car would be, but actually my wife and I were talking about this the other day, that in terms of anything that's being made right now, we need a new Suburban. There isn't anything that really makes my heart go pity-pat. That's beautiful Alpha Aston Martin. There's beautiful Aston Martin out there. But I don't know. I think if I had unlimited budget for cars, it'd be old stuff.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Chuck in Dallas. Hello, Chuck.
Hey, Eddie.
How you doing?
Hey, pretty good. So, gearhead guy here, car-wise, I like just safe and convenient. Two-wheel-wise. Tell the world what you think about the quality of writing of my favorite moto journalist, Kevin Cameron.
I don't actually know Kevin Cameron's stuff, but I do know a little bit about two wheels. And I had a couple motorcycles, and I smacked them up immediately. And I smacked them both up, and I smacked them up a couple of times. And I just smacked up my bigger Suzuki that I had. And I think that due to the 10,000 votive candles that my mother had lit, it was stolen.
They burned to this day.
They burned to this day. I had just gotten enough money together to get it repaired when it was stolen out of the backyard of my campus housing. And I love motorcycles. I absolutely love motorcycles, but they scare me so badly. And modern motorcycles I can ride a Harley all right, but you get me on one of these modern rice rockets. I mean, my reaction times are just not adequate to a big Kawasaki or a big Suzuki or a Ducati or anything like that. They just start too fast, stop too fast, turn too fast, everything. For a 62-year-old guy, just suicidal. And my wife feels so strongly about this that she was thinking about using our dog training collar on our 6-year-old son, not at a high level, not at a real painful level. At a humane level for a 6-year-old. Just to sit him on a motorcycle and then hit the reminder button and do this several times in the hope that when he turned 16 and saw a motorcycle, he'd go, oh, I don't know, something makes me very uncomfortable about that.
Or else he'll miss the shock when he sits down.
Exactly.
Are you aggressive behind the wheel? Does your personality change?
No. I am not aggressive. As a matter of fact, I have a piece that I'm going to do for Car and Driver sometime this winter, and now that the school year has started, called Driving Like a Mother. And to my mind, the most aggressive drivers out there are mothers with cars full of kids, all of whom have to be someplace.
Within nine minutes
of each other, yeah. School tennis lesson, and cello lesson, math coach, grocery store, doctor's appointment, vet appointment, and home,
And three birthday parties.
And three birthday parties, right, exactly. The kids coming out of there in the sugar high, and like six other kids you got to take with the three kids that you've got. And these women are maniacs, So I'm going to undertake to do the family driving for a week. And see whether I survive. I just noodle down the road. When I drive fast, and I do like to drive fast, I do it with intent. I will find a patch of what I hope is fairly well abandoned road, that I know is good and curvy and it's got the right kind of road service and surface in it. And I hope the police aren't around or the various places around the country. And then I'll get on it. But it's a sport. It's like playing golf. You don't go out and just knock the ball around your neighborhood. You go to a golf course. I don't go to a race course, but I know there's certain roads and certain places that I know that I can drive fast, and I'll have a lot of fun with that. But when I'm going to the hardware store and doing the other kind of errands that you can get men to do, which are few, I just noodle around. You know, I want to see if anybody's got a new rider mower in the area, or, you know, whether their tractor's working, or, you know, what's that excavator doing over there? You know, so no, I'm not aggressive at all.
Among the many suggestions that you have for President Obama is a national, what do you call it, a linear national park.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm actually kind of half serious about this. This is a piece I did for a little on a website called Winding Road, which was, I thought that, you know, that there are a lot of people in America who love to drive fast, and there are fewer and fewer places where you can drive fast. And I was thinking we should block off certain areas, you know, in remote places in the United States, you know, out in the depopulated Middle West and so on, where maybe you'd have to have a special license. Maybe doubtless you'd have to have a special fee. But you could just – no speed limits. You could just drive like the Dickens. You know, maybe you'd have to wear a safety helmet or whatever.
Sign a waiver.
Sign a waiver, doubtless. You know, does ever, you have to sign a waiver to do anything today. Just go to a Chuck E. Cheese. You have to sign a waiver. And, you know, these roads would be not blocked off, but limited access like our highway system is, or maybe they have crossing gates at them like a railroad train does. But there would be places, linear national parks, where you could just go drive like the Dickens. And I thought, you know, the U.S. government could make a little money for the Park Service this way. People could have some fun. Why not?
We'll go next to Grand Prairie, and Mike is on the line there. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, I wanted to see if I'm the bad driver, but I've driven rental cars in New York City and from Rome to Paris on the autobahn,
yes.
Heavy traffic and wide open. And I drive since 42 years ago with the right foot for the accelerator and the left for the brake on an automatic. Is that... Do you drive that way? Or
I don't, but I'll tell you, every Afghan cab driver in Washington, D.C. does. And I'm in the back seat getting sick. You know, and I'll tell you who else drove like that was my grandfather. My grandfather, the guy who was like right there at the invention of the automobile, who'd been involved in the automobile before Fords were involved in the automobile. And he always drove like that with one foot on the accelerator and one foot on the brake. I think the problem is, I think it's fine with rented cars, but I think the problem is what you're going to do is you're going to, you know, by riding the brake, like riding the clutch, you wear out the mechanism. You modern brakes are so sensitive that you are unintentionally slightly rubbing your brake pads against the discs in your disc brakes, and hence you're going to go through brake pads at about three times or four times the rate if you do that.
In your mind, what is the dumbest thing that has become standard in a car that you can buy in 2009?
Well, it actually doesn't come with the car. I think it is the cell phone.
Yeah.
Although I got to say, the whole MapQuest, the Canadians call Bossy Betty, you know, the thing that drives
turn around. Left here.
Turn left here. And I found that this may work fine out here in Texas, or may not, I couldn't say. But in New England, which is just a rat's nest of roads, I mean, it just really looks like somebody balled up a bunch of kite twine and threw it on a map, you know, in terms of the – there's one little place in Massachusetts right near where I live. Well, I think there are seven different roads come together. And there's like one road where if you go down it, you are going west on one numbered road, south on another numbered road, north on a third numbered road, and indeterminate direction on a fourth. I mean, and it's just, and the MapQuest just falls apart under these circumstances. So if I plug in something like Logan Airport, it has a tendency to take me there by way of Bangor, Maine. But what it's done is it's destroyed the ability of a whole generation of Americans to read a map.
Yeah, I don't ever get directions from a map. I go straight to the computer.
Everybody does. And the directions you get are sort of like directions from your old Aunt Edna. Now, you go down to where the – you know where the barn was? It burned down in 58, but where the barn was – it's like they're bad directions. And I'm on the road a fair amount giving some talks and do some business speaking. And the lecture bureau sets up all my travel, which is fine with the air travel. But then – I can't get them to look at a map. So they will fly me from Dallas to Fort Worth. Look at a map! Look at a map! They're next to each other. You know? And yeah, it really has. It's destroyed the map reading skills of a whole generation of Americans.
I think we have time for one more call, and we will go with Brian in Mansfield. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Brian. You there? Oops.
Okay, lost.
Hello. Oh, there
hi,
he
Brian.
Is.
Go ahead, please.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, I'm in down in Mansfield. I liked your comment about you know, learning to drive young. I grew up in a real small town in Oregon, and well, just out on dirt roads, started learning at about the age of 11 or 12. And,
yeah.
And snuck out my my mom's VW Beetle when she was out sometimes, and just went out on those dirt roads doing fishtails for, I don't know, hours at a time. But great memories doing that. But I had a question about cars themselves. I'm looking on the internet right now as I'm listening to this, and I'm seeing a Mercedes-Benz SCL 600 that is driven by a joystick. And it seems like, I mean, the basic design of the car since its inception, the four wheels, a motor somewhere, a steering wheel, it hasn't really changed by design much other than the technology. What do you see for the future of cars as we move forward, like six wheels or three wheels or, you know, different configurations? Is there any vision beyond what we see as the ordinary architecture of a car?
I actually think we've gotten there already, and that is, I think you're going to see virtually universal four-wheel drive. I think people have come to realize what a benefit that is, not just in snow and ice, but also in the rain and under most other circumstances. Other than that, I think that, you know, all attempts to change the basic steering wheel have come to grief, you know, the joystick. And I'm not even sure there's these the whole paddle switch Formula One style gear shifting strikes me as also being, as an old stick shift guy, as being deeply unsatisfying. I think we may see, especially driven by the less expensive vehicles from Asia, from mainland Asia, we may see a return to a more simple automobile. I think, you know, I get into a new car and I'm perplexed what all these buttons and stuff are. And I think we may have improved ourselves out of business in that respect.
P.J. O'Rourke was my guest this hour. His newest book is called Driving Like Crazy, 30 Years of Vehicular Hellbending. P.J., it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been fun.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.
How do you make your resume stand out? One company thinks video is the answer.
My shtick is about the energy I bring to a room. If somebody sees me on a video, there's a higher likelihood that they're going to get what my personality is about.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, YouTube Resumes, next time on Marketplace from American Public Media.
This evening at 6:30 on KERA 90.1.
This is your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA, Dallas-Fort Worth, Denton. And online at KERA.org. Also, 100.1 K261 CW, Tyler. 88.3 K202 DR, Wichita Falls. And 99.3 K257 EV Sherman. Think continues on your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1.
Chris Boyd. Up next on an archive edition of Think, a century of Hollywood costume design. Last summer, we spoke with Academy Award-nominated costume designer Deborah Nadulman Landis, whose film credits include Animal House, The Blues Brothers, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Thriller. We talked about how she tells stories through wardrobe and about the painstaking care that goes into dressing actors for their roles. Our archive conversation starts after the news from National Public Radio.